Welcome to episode 32 of About Nashville with Mike Rogers. I'm Mike Rogers, and with me is my co-host, Miss Holly.
Hey!
Today is part two of two with our guest, Jimmy Adams, who is a business partner of Don King and former boxing manager of Ernie Shavers, Burt Cooper, Oliver McCall, Greg Page, Riddick Bowe, Tony Tucker, and many, many, many others. Last week, you heard the first part of our candid conversation, and this week, you're going to hear the rest. Again, guys, this was a completely exclusive interview. Fans of boxing all over. You guys, if you ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of big-time boxing in the fight game, this is it. He shared details that have never, ever before been disclosed before to the press or anybody else about the great careers of the boxers I've mentioned and what eventually happened to some of them. And some of it might make you cry. Some of it might just leave you shocked. It's just, he was very candid about the situation. And Jimmy also debunked a few myths for me regarding Don King that was enlightening. They say you play football, you play baseball, and you can even play hockey, but you can't ever play boxing or you will get hurt. This interview reveals the good, the bad, and the ugly of the sport. So it was really interesting. I'll tell you something else interesting. You know, we had that whole conversation, and we put that question out there for people to call us on what they thought. But the question was, do you think that there really is a health issue with Hillary Clinton, or do you think that it was, you know, this is something drummed up by, you know, whatever? And not one call came in.
Really?
Not one. And I think as I was, I looked all weekend.
Okay.
I drove around and I was looking in people's yards and I was looking at their bumpers and I noticed not one sign and not one bumper sticker for not either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton.
Really?
Yeah.
So
not
you
one.
Were that guy in my yard.
That was me. That was me trying to, you know, I was like, there's
this creepy guy in my
exactly,
yard.
Exactly. That was me. And I did. And then I was like, wait a minute, what? Why? Because, you know, in every single election that we've ever seen previously, you've always seen, it didn't matter who they were.
Right.
You saw tons of bumper stickers and signs and everything, and they're just not out there. And I'm wondering if this isn't the most polarizing election on the face of the planet, to the point that, I mean, here's two parts to this. I don't think that we've ever had an election in American history that has ever been this polarizing with two candidates that are unfavorably viewed by everybody, including most people in their parties.
That's sad to say, but it's very true.
I can't tell, you know, and I tried thinking and I thought for a minute, you know, Adams Jefferson was kind of, it was pretty bitter, but it didn't, you know, divide the country.
Right.
And, Douglas Lincoln was ugly, but it didn't, you know, obviously it led up, you know, it was one of the contributing factors that led up to the Civil War, but
right.
It didn't, the people that were rooting for the people that they were rooting for, they were open about who they were, you know, they were supportive.
Right.
There was a reason that they thought in their minds and hearts that they were supporting whatever they were, and they were open about it.
Right. You think people are scared to be open?
Well, as I'm thinking about all this, I'm looking at it and I'm going to myself, this is the questions that I'm left with are this. Are the choices so dismal for everyone that we are still trying to decide who to vote for?
I think it's more embarrassing.
And or is it that because both candidates have been calling each other's supporters these horrible names, that they just choose not to openly support them to keep any kind of conflict happening in so that leaves me to question, you know, other things like, okay, does that mean that one of the candidates does not have the support that they need to win, and the other one has quiet support that's going to win them election?
I think that may be the case in both parties.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, it could be either one. I don't know. But
right.
Does it mean that one of the groups is like, okay, I don't want to be labeled. I don't want to be this. I don't want to be that. You know, I don't want to, you know, whatever. And the other is just quietly saying, well, I'm just going to let my vote, you know.
But I really see a lack of interest.
And then there's that. Are people just not inspired?
Right. But they're going to exercise their right because it's their right. But as far as actually supporting, I don't really see it.
I think the voter turnout is going to be very, very poor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
if it's very high, like you said, I mean, you're so embarrassed about and to share that with people. It's like, so anyway, who wants to share it?
Yeah, and I'm not going to make this a political show. This is not a political show. It was just an observation that I made,
okay,
you know, over the weekend, and I was kind of shocked because nobody, you know, responded to our question.
Right.
So I'm going to make the question a whole lot easier this week. But I'm not going to say it yet. No, I'll go ahead and say it.
Share it.
Yeah, I'll say it. The question of the week for everybody is going to be, what do you love the most about Nashville? Not the show, about the city, Nashville.
What do you love
the most about Nashville?
Good question.
So call the About Nashville Feedback Hotline, 615-852-5552, 615-852-5552, and let us know what you love about Nashville. I'll tell you. Did you hear that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are getting divorced?
Yes, I did.
I did.
That sucks.
That shocked me.
That sucks. All those kids they got.
I know.
All the ones they adopted and heck.
And none of them are like his blood. So
right.
He's like going to have to pay child support on all these
gonna
kids.
He's going to have to.
He didn't even give birth to.
That's right.
You know, he's trying to save the world. Yep. And he needs to.
Yeah, he's going to save some pockets.
I'm telling you. Holy cow. Look at that. 22 kids.
Is that how many they have?
I know.
No,
it's a lot. It's a lot.
It's not 22.
No, it's not 22.
Oh. Okay.
But it's a lot.
So sounds like my dad. No, I'm kidding.
No.
I'm kidding. He killed me.
yeah, right. Well, then he had 21.
Now six, just six.
I was shocked when I read that. I was like, oh my goodness. Yeah. So I was going to make an entire episode out of I tried out for this comedy show on NBC over the
weekend.
How'd
it go?
So I'm going to tell you. I was going to make an entire episode out of the experience of what it was like to do this. But that would be the shortest episode on the face of the planet.
Did they boot you off?
So, I will just explain over here to you what happened so that you know, because there's no point in using a whole episode for this. I don't know. It depends. I met some really cool people.
Did you really?
I did. I met some really cool people.
Good.
So I was scared. I was going to sleep in my car outside of the club. Well, because I have been in a lot of contests. I've been in a lot of auditions. I've been in a lot of things in my entire life.
Okay.
When you open an open thing like this, especially to somebody like NBC,
right.
There's going to be hundreds, if not thousands of people waiting in line to do this. So that's what I had in my head. And so I'm like, well, maybe I need to spend the night out here. Because they're only taking the first 100.
Okay.
If you weren't in the first 100, you didn't get to audition.
Wow. Okay.
So that's why I had that mindset.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, maybe I need to sleep out in my car. But I as I got home and I was working out, I worked out. You have to have two auditions. At 9 a.m. when they opened it up, you got a 1 minute audition, 60 seconds.
Okay.
To be as funny as you can be.
In 1 minute. Okay.
And then if you got called back, you came back at 3 o'clock that day, and then you got 2 minutes.
Oh.
And then if you were funny after that 2 minutes, you got to come back on Sunday and do a 5 minute set in front of a live audience.
Okay.
So apparently some people were given, professional comedians, not just people walking off the street, but there were some professional comedians that were given the opportunity to bypass that 9 o'clock set, and they went straight to the 3 o'clock. Yeah. But they were pros. I mean, they were some really good pros.
Okay.
And so I worked my whole minute set out in my head as to how I was going to do it and practiced it several times. And but that was all. I only worked out one type of minute set.
Right.
And then I showed up and I left the house at 6 o'clock in the morning and got there about 6:30, and there was probably about, I think I was the 69th person that signed up.
Really?
Yeah. And there only ended up being like 90.
Oh, okay. You could have got there whatever time. Maybe.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Well, no, there was some people that showed up after 9 o'clock that didn't get into the whatever they're supposed to do and turned away. But
okay.
So I was like 69, which great number, but I was 69.
Awesome.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Wasn't a sign of things to come. It just meant I sucked.
Aww.
It just validated. Hey, Mike, you suck. We're going to prove it. So I stand out there, and it starts raining. And I have my gear.
Saturday
morning. Yeah.
Okay.
And it starts raining, and I had to go get my, I've got all my recording equipment with me because I'm talking to myself in front of all these people recording this episode.
Really?
Really, really. And comedians are, or maybe it's just artists, but you know, they see a phone, they're like a camera or a microphone, yeah, or whatever else, and they gravitate toward
it. Right, right.
So they started coming towards me and wanting to talk. Hey, what you doing? I'm like, hey. And so,
really?
Yeah, yeah. So I met some really nice people. I really did. A lot of them came in from Atlanta, Ohio, all these different places. And they were super, super nice. I only saw a very, very few people that I've seen out on open mics in the local area. Very few.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Most of the people that were there were from other states.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm standing out there in the rain with my umbrella, and I'm trying to keep this one woman who doesn't have an umbrella, I'm trying to keep her from not getting wet.
What a gentleman.
She was such a sweet lady. Her name was Mutt, and she's from Smyrna.
Okay.
I know. I didn't ask, but, but apparently it's her show name. And
Okay.
And she's from Smyrna. She's a comedian. She hadn't been doing it for very long. Maybe I think she said a year or something like that. And so we all were standing in line and raining, and we probably stood out there for 2 hours.
Really?
3 hours, something like that.
In the rain?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably why I got a cold.
Yeah, you sound a little stuffy.
Yeah, yeah. So then I get in there, and we all sit down. And it dawns on me, I got 60 seconds, okay?
Right.
And I didn't, how do I put this? I think to be a good artist or be a good comedian, you need to be flexible. And
right.
You need to be able to alter your set to the room that you're playing to.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do that because I was locked in. I was, first of all, I'm green as graveyard moss.
Right.
So I'm just like, I'm so, okay. I'm like a little baby deer though. I'm just like falling all over the place and everything. And, you know, but I was locked into a certain set,
right,
that didn't necessarily, I knew wasn't going to work for this room because the theme for this particular comedy show or whatever else was diversity.
Did you know that prior to going in?
Sort of. We figured it out toward the last part of it, but I'd already locked it in.
Okay.
And my wife's like, these jokes might not work. You might offend people with this. This is, you know.
Hey, that's you.
I know.
That's
she's like, you might want to back off these jokes. These ain't, you know, this is diversity and this isn't very diverse. Some of these things you're saying in these jokes. And I'm like, baby, I don't care. I'm a comedian.
That's right.
I'm a comedian and I don't care if I offend anybody. I find it funny, damn it.
And, that's right.
And she's like, yeah, but you might want to consider who you're telling the jokes to. And so I didn't get many laughs.
Why didn't you do Pray For Me? You know that's diverse. Everybody understands that.
Well, I thought about it. I thought about it.
But the damage was done.
It was done. I probably would have been better if I'd have talked about some boxing or if I'd have talked about some country music. I probably would
have. Well, they were expecting that.
Yeah, I kind of focused in on some other things.
Oh.
And
I know you don't like just to share your.
No, no.
Okay,
I'll show you.
Okay.
I'll show you after this is over, and I'll show you just exactly how.
Okay.
How
bad
I really was. It's like
not diverse.
And you know,
you were.
It's like, and you tell the punchline, and you're like. And walks in the bar and this would have it. And people are like,
crickets. Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah, it's like, and then the cat said, shakabamadam.
And then the bell rings in your.
And people just like looking at me like, what the shit? His 60 seconds ain't coming quick enough. I feel like I'm on a bull. Holy hell.
Really?
Because the first 8 seconds hurt like hell. Yeah, it was
really.
Yeah, That 60 seconds got real long. It got real long.
Oh, bummer. I hate that.
So apparently, I did learn from one of the comedians that actually made it through to the next round, that in a situation like that, they do what's called rapid fire comedy.
Okay.
Where it's a line you set up and boom, you drop the punchline. And line set up, boom, you drop. But I thought, hell, if I did that for a solid minute, I wouldn't have nothing to say in my 2 minute thing.
Yeah, that's a whole show right there.
You know, because all my jokes are pretty much set up stories. Right. They're set up stories. So it wouldn't work. Anyway, make a long story short.
It was
sucked.
An experience.
It was an experience. Good. You know what? I learned several things from it.
Good.
I learned I'm not funny. I learned several things from it. First of all, I learned what rapid fire comedy was and how it works.
Right.
I learned that you have to adjust your comedy for the room you're playing.
Right.
I had to learn that you need to have a slew of sets put in line so that you can be flexible.
Right.
I learned that this is an art, you know, and it's not just something you just pick up a microphone and take off doing. It's something
I would never
try it. You'd be good at it.
Shh.
You would.
You'd be glad I can't cuss because I'd be cussing.
You'd be good at it. You'd be good. But anyway, it was a great experience. I loved it. It is what it is. Second thing, third thing, fourth thing, I don't know, whatever. So my wife and I, we've already gone through the entire sixth season of Walking Dead on Netflix.
Why?
Because she was absolutely addicted to it. We probably watched 2 or 3 episodes a day.
Oh, no. Really?
Yes. So, I think it was 16 episodes or what that made up the entire...
Really?
Yeah. We went through them like what do they say? A hot knife on butter?
I don't know.
Yeah, we went through them pretty quick. It was
really
good. Yeah, to the point now, she's like, oh, my gosh. Number one... I hate that I have to wait till October 23rd to find out what's going to happen. Number two, I can't believe that I'm going to have to wait a week every single week after that just to find out what's going to happen. So I'm like, yeah, and you got to sit through commercials too.
That's right.
She loves it.
Yeah.
And she loves all the characters and she loves, I can't say too much because I don't know where. Have you even started it?
I have not, but I'm going to. I promise. Before the new season comes on.
October 23rd?
3 weeks. 4 weeks. I have 4 weeks.
To watch 6 seasons of Walking Dead?
No, that means I'll start. I'll start.
Whatever.
I will.
Mm-hmm.
I promise.
All right. Anyway, everybody out there, remember the question of the week is, what do you love the most about Nashville? Call the About Nashville feedback hotline, 615-852-5552. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at About Nashville. Email the show if you have questions, suggestions, or you just want to cuss us, aboutnashville@gmail.com. Anyway.
I need you to get some for that cold.
So let me tell you about some Nashville news.
Okay.
All right. So we've talked about some pop culture news, and we talked about some whatever, but national news. So let's talk about some Nashville news. This weekend, or no, it's not this weekend. Maybe this weekend. It's
Get it together.
Well, I know. The Fall Tennessee Craft Fair will be at Centennial Park September 23rd through the 25th, where you will be able to buy handmade craft art of so many mediums that are offered for sale. It will be Friday and Saturday, September 23rd through the 25th, 10 a.m. through 6 p.m. Sunday, it will be 10 a.m. through 5 p.m. Admission is free and open to the public. It is at Centennial Park, the Fall Tennessee Craft Fair.
That's this week.
Yeah.
And fall is what?
This weekend, yeah.
Friday.
It is.
Thursday or fall? Wow. Is it Thursday or Friday?
When does the time jump back or jump forward or whatever
it is? I don't know.
When does that happen?
It's fall forward. I don't know.
I think it's fall forward. It might be this weekend.
Is it?
I don't know. I think it might be.
Need to check on that.
It's getting darker later, for sure.
Darker earlier, not later.
Earlier. I'm drinking more. It's just,
That's the NyQuil you're on.
Yeah. So I'm not on NyQuil. Go to the Fall Tennessee Craft Fair at Centennial Park. You ever been to that?
I have not.
You make crafts?
I do.
No, you're so full. You full of craft.
Christmas tree ornaments and everything.
Really?
Yeah, you know, you take the popsicle sticks, you put X's and crosses, and you know.
Yeah, you might not want to send your stuff to the fair. I don't believe they'll let you in.
I blame it on my son.
So the next event we have is also this weekend. It is Nashville Chalk Fest at Fannie Mae Dees Park. Nashville Chalk Fest, Fannie Mae Dees Park. It's September 24th and 25th. Now, Nashville Chalk Fest is free. It's a two-day street event painting festival with entertainment, food, and family fun, featuring sidewalk chalk art by professional artists and hobbyists. Now, you'll need to go to Belcourt. I think it's at Belcourt and 24th Avenue next to Fannie Mae Dees Park. The times are Saturday, September 24th from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Sunday, and September 25th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. That sounds like fun. You ever seen like chalk art on the side of the road?
I have, but I don't know.
You don't know what?
I don't know about the chalk art.
I bet it looks good.
Oh, I'm sure it does.
I hope it doesn't rain.
I'm sure it's not supposed to.
Because if it rains this weekend, then it's going to be hard to keep the chalk art down. Yeah, be kind of muddy art. I don't know. I've never heard of that festival, but it sounds cool.
It does.
I bet my little girls would love it.
Yeah, James has a birthday coming up, so maybe I'll take him.
What's his birthday?
September 30th.
How old is he going to be?
6.
That's next weekend.
It is.
Yeah, that's next Friday?
Next Friday, yeah.
Yeah. Boy.
Yep.
All right, well... you got anything? How was your weekend?
I don't. It was pretty good. I didn't do a lot. I went to bingo.
Bingo?
Bingo. B-I-N-G-O.
Did you win?
Heck no.
B-I-N-O. I did not win.
B-I-N-G. Heck no.
B-I did not win. Heck no. N-O. B-I-N-O.
But it was fun. It was fun.
All right.
It just blows my mind to see so many elderly people who have oxygen tanks who would sit in a cloud of smoke all day.
Are they smoking while they got them?
No, but they may as well be. Secondhand is worse.
Ooh, why is it worse?
I don't know. That's just what they say. I don't know.
Who is they?
I don't smoke.
Who is they?
I don't know. The Attorney General.
Somebody's lying. I don't know about all that. So you're getting the secondhand smoke at the bingo.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to the rest of the interview with Jimmy Adams. Let's do this thing.
I'm a knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the Honky Tonk Hitman. A knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the Honky Tonk Hitman.
Welcome to About Nashville with your host, the Honky Tonk Hitman, Mike Rogers.
So let's talk about that. So how did you get the whole Mix Factory thing set up? And there was two or three things that were going on that were so powerful at that particular time. And I'll tell you a little bit of a story that you may not know. So there was the facility that you were talking about with Excalibur that was going on, where all the fighters were training and everything.
Yeah.
And then there was the facility down there in Nashville downtown at the Mix Factory. And then there was you that was working with Don King and putting on all of the fights that were taking place and training the fighters that were down there at the Excalibur. And that was where I made my pro debut in swimming trunks and tennis shoes and a cowboy hat. How did all that take place? How did you put all that together? Because this town will never see that ever again. That was incredible.
A lot of people trying to recreate it, but I don't think it could be done. I get a lot of people call me about it. You know, hey, look, Jimmy, get involved with us. We want to redo what you already done.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's, you know, I don't get involved with them. I don't go forward. You know, I had a promoter from North Carolina call me and getting his license here now. He said, I want to get you involved with me. And I'm like, you can't recreate that. Mm-hmm. You know, I had too many ingredients I was blessed with that you don't have today. And so when I got it, you know, every commission in the United States turned down Al McCall fighting. They said he was brain damaged and this and that. You know, he was crazy. So what I done, I took him in Vegas. The commission, and what Don King wanted, Don Oliver, evaluated by the number one psychiatrist in the world, and considered in America. And she was in Vegas, and so we did that. The next morning after the fight, we went to the psychiatrist, you know, and she actually done both of us, you know, and so she cleared him. She said, no, he's smart as a tack, you know, I mean, and so, you know, he would come out, he would want to say that, well, I did it because I want to be like my, that was my rope-a-dope and all that stuff, you know, but, you know, that's just garbage. That wasn't true. You know, that he just, like I say, mentally, it messed with him because he didn't knock him out. And if he'd have knocked him out in the second round, none of that, no crown would ever happen, you know. If he could have knocked him out like he planned. But, you know, it's just no different than, I look at it in a way like this here. It's no different of you and I if we had something we wanted to do and we trained hard for it and we done this and done that to get it. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's about riding a bicycle 10 miles without stop pedaling, period. If we was to not succeed in that, it breaks your heart.
Right.
You're depressing yourself.
Sure.
And I think that's what's happened with him, as I said in that fight. So what happened to all the commissions, even though I went and I got the psychiatrist to do him, I got MRIs, eyes. I got everything from the head to the toe. I got everything checked out. Complete physicals. I had all my documentation to show that he is okay to fight. But the commission suspended him. They suspended him. No, he couldn't fight anywhere. So I went to Mark Ratner. And so when I started pulling all these documents over to Mark Ratner and all, I said, Mark, you know me well enough to know that if he wasn't bad, I would not put him in the ring. I said, guy, he just got cross. And I told Mark, I said, he just had a problem that night that we didn't know. Don King didn't know. I didn't know. Nobody stuck him, because right there in the dressing room, if Oliver looked at me and said, hey, I can't do this fight, I don't want to fight, I'd have called the fight off with the crowd, TV and all that.
Right.
I would not have pushed him in there. And so all them things that people say is not true.
Right, right.
It's not true.
Well, they can be backed up, too, by medical records.
Yeah, by medical records. Yeah. And so what I did, Mark told me, he said, Jimmy, if you can find a place to fight him, get him started back, and we can show, and then I'll lift it for him to come to Vegas to fight. But he said, I will lift the suspension right now if you fight him somewhere else.
Okay. So that's what created the whole...
That's what
enticed you to come to Nashville and do it here.
Yeah. So anyway, I found Nashville, and I can't remember the commission name. You might remember Dan or something.
I can't remember. It seems like we've had a few since then.
Yeah. So whatever his name was back then, he's not there now. But
no.
But I went to.
They don't even have a commission anymore, I don't think.
Oh, really?
I don't think they do.
So I went to him, and I explained it, and I showed him all my records and all. And I said, listen, I bring boxing to Nashville, and I said, I'll build Nashville. I'll fight every week. I put Nashville on the map. And he looked at me and laughed, because, you know, because Nashville always wanted to have a boxing presence here.
It used to in the 50s.
Yeah.
In the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. It did. You're right. And so anyway, he looked at me, he said, okay. He said, let's do it. So he licensed Oliver and then went to the Mixed Factory, and Oliver fought every week. We fought 10 weeks back to back. Let him off, then I think he fought three more. Then that's when the fight started coming back in. So then end up going back fighting for the title again.
So you did something in 1997 that was phenomenal. I believe, were the bouts on Thursday nights?
Tuesday
nights. David Hudson and I were debating over whether they were Tuesday night. I said Tuesday, and he said Thursday.
No, it's Tuesday.
But I thought it was Tuesday night fights down there at Mixed Factory. And you put on a show every single week, a great card, for how many weeks straight?
For a year straight.
For a solid year straight.
54 weeks, and didn't miss a week.
Goodness great. Yeah, because I remember I fought there from 97 to 98, and then I started fighting other places because it stopped.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have ever gone to other places if it hadn't. I mean, I'll tell you something that you may not know, and how you and I got to start working together. So in my second pro fight, I boxed one of your guys, Tom Gavin,
right.
And I beat him from ring post to ring post and didn't get the decision. And I thought, okay, I'm done with boxing. I'll leave 1-1. And I'm sitting in the dressing room and I'm getting ready. And Greg Page and Nick Rupa come and talk to me.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, hey man, you can fight a little bit. Why don't you come box with us? And I'm like, I came here to be a singer. I didn't really come here to be a fighter. And they're like, well, do you have a job? And I'm like, well, no, but boxing doesn't really seem like a stable job to me. They were like, come to the gym and then we'll make sure you have a job. And I'm like, okay. And so that was what started me going down there and working with Greg and Nick down there at the Excalibur Boxing Gym. And then I met you and then started boxing. But I got to ask you, how come you never gave me the rematch with Tom Gavin? I begged and begged for it.
You did beg me for it. And you know what? Tom wouldn't fight you again.
Oh, my gosh.
Listen, I travel. I called him everywhere. I called him back because he lived in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
I called him in Virginia. And so anyway, he said, because people followed you. I mean, you had people follow you, and they liked you. They liked your image coming in the ring and all. And so I thought it'd be something that the people did want to see a rematch. I even had a lot of people say, hey, why don't you get him back to fight him again?
Mm-hmm.
And I tried. And then he moved to Arizona. And I called him in there. Somebody gave me the number from hometown. I called him in Arizona. And because I found out he was fighting in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Tom, come to the Mix Factor. I want you to fight. And he said, who do you want me to fight? I said, I want you to fight Mike Rogers. He said, no. I said, why? He said, I don't want to fight. He said, I'm going to cherish that win over him for the rest of my life. He said, I don't want to fight him again.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm going to tell you, off the record here, which we ain't off the record, but I'm going to tell you, I told him, I said, listen, I'll tell you what I do. If you come and fight him, I said, between me and you, I give you $1,000 extra. He said, are you serious? And I said, yeah. He said, I want $5,000.
Oh, so he's going to bump it.
I said, you got it.
Okay.
He said, I was just joking.
Oh,
so,
man.
And let me know, no matter what. So I quit chasing him then.
Yeah, I was like, at that particular point, I was like, I didn't care if it was an 8-round or a 10-round or whatever else. If you'd have put $5,000 on the line, he wouldn't have got out of 1 round.
You know, I'm telling you, I told him. I said, listen, that's what I do. And he said, I don't want to fight him. But he never gave me a real reason why, except for...
Yeah, he just gave it. He just wanted
to keep that win over you.
Yep, yep. He pulled a Leonard on me.
Yeah. So it's a Leonard Hager deal, yeah. So, you know, but he wouldn't fight. But I tried to put it together because so many people talked about it.
Yeah, it was a fun time. So then you started work. Golly, you have worked with a ton of great fighters in that period. Tony Tucker,
yeah.
Riddick Bowe, Oliver McCall. There were a ton of great fighters that came through there as they were training and making their debut right there. I didn't even know that Mia St. John made her debut.
Started
there.
Right there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that was lucky, I was lucky, was my relationship with Don. Because,
mm-hmm.
See, Don would be signing all these fighters, but he wasn't having all these fights.
Mm-hmm.
So what Don would do, he would call me and give me names of fighters to put on the card. And so he made the outlet work for him. Because he'd have these contracts, these fighters that had to fight 3 times a year or whatever. And so instead of going and putting on a big fight somewhere and losing all that money,
mm-hmm.
he would call me and pay for the fighter plus the opponent.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I had no expense.
Right.
And that's why, and I told the guy the other day, they were weak, that wants to come in and fight. I said, listen, one, I had a building that mm-hmm. paid money.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to pay for the building. I said, it paid money. And I said, two, I had a promoter, another promoter, that was sending me fighters and paying all that expense.
Uh-huh.
I said, so, you know, I had everything, the ingredients you need to make the pie.
Who brought you to Paul Eichel? Was that the guy that owned Mix Factory?
Yeah, Jeff Hargis.
Okay, Jeff Hargis.
Yeah.
So you started talking with Jeff Hargis because he was a promoter. Jeff Hargis set up the situation at Mix Factory with Paul Eichel, and then you brought your influence in with Don King to make them legitimate cards. I mean, you gave new fighters like me the opportunity to fight on cards for, you know, Oliver McCall and all these other different fighters, these big name fighters that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And you put on some big shows here. What happened to Paul Eichel and Jeff Hargis and all these guys?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. the club started getting out of hand.
Okay.
There was a girl who got raped on the steps and stairway.
I've never heard that.
Yeah. A girl got raped on the stairway. Then it started becoming drug dealers were coming in. And, you know, a lot of drug transition started happening and stuff, you know.
At the club or at the fights?
At the fight. Well, I was there only on Tuesday nights. Okay. I'm not a clubber, so Tuesday nights on time I was even there.
Oh, I didn't know if there were things that were happening at the club that affected the ability to put on fights there.
Well, see, what happened, because, you know, after the fight, that's what Paul really racked up at, because after the fight, he had the people who wanted to come dance, but after the fight, the crowd there would go upstairs to the club.
Yeah.
They go upstairs to the club, they turn the ring down, everything, you got four stories of this clubbing.
Right.
Which started getting crazy.
Yeah.
You know. And so then, you know, after the girl got raped and all, you know, and then all that stuff, you know, I said, whoa, you know, it's getting crazy here. Mm-hmm. I'm going back to Virginia.
Okay.
So that's when I quit.
That was in early 98 then, or middle of, it was maybe the, well, I can't remember.
I think it was early 98.
Was it like April of 98 or something like that? Okay.
Because then I said, oh, listen, I'm going back to Virginia.
I packed up quick
and just left. Well, one, I didn't want to be involved with all that craziness. Mm-hmm. And then, you know what? It's just like, I mean, I started looking at it and I said, okay, I pulled 54 weeks out. I put Nashville, David Klein, and done a thing, which was really the coolest thing to me. I was real honored. The 50 greatest sports figures in the state of Tennessee, and I was number 21. I beat out the governor. I beat out Vince Gill. Vince Gill was 48. And that was just an honor to me, and I didn't even live here then.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they did that, you know, I mean, to me, I achieved a whole lot. I mean, I got interviews all over the world. I had people flying from London to interview me about how many fights was happening here. And so, you know, and then, you know, the list of the most fights in 97 was California, Tennessee, and then Las Vegas.
Wow.
So Tennessee was number two. And we only missed being the number one spot, I think, about three, four fights.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't many.
So there's one other thing that I want to clear the air about, because I want to take up for you, because there was an ugly article that came out in like 97 or 98 or whatever, where they were talking about homeless people fighting on the cards and things of that nature. And I want to, on the record, I want to sit here and say that Jimmy Adams did not make one single match ever for me that was involved with anybody like that. As a matter of fact, you know, if there were homeless people on there, or if there were people that had not had a lot of fights and stuff, you know, there's a lot of people that all over the country and all of the different, you know, it doesn't matter where they're coming from. You know, that's up to the commission to take care of those kind of things.
Exactly.
And I never saw you involved in anything like that. So no. I just wanted to clear the air on that one.
Well, thank you, Mike. And I know it was. Like, I've got that a whole lot. You know, people say, well, you went to a homeless bus station and all this stuff. And it's not true. But, you know, I learned from Don King. Like Don's always told me, said, Jimmy, when people start stuff like that with you, it's like you adding and you make a comment, it's like adding a log to the fire. And that's why I never come back forward and said anything.
Mm-hmm.
I let them say what they want to say, because I know what the truth is. I never did.
Right.
The only thing I ever made a comment back to them, well, you know what? I'm not the commission, and I ain't the doctor.
Right.
Approved. I ain't the one who licensed them.
Right. And, you know, here's one that I get all the time, and it's like, you know, I hear you fought homeless people or whatever else. And the truth of the matter is, in my very first fight, I was living in my car. Yeah. So, I mean, I was one of those guys. My first professional license is the bar to, oh, gosh, what was that guy's name? Eddie Rines. I didn't have a home, so I put the address of his bar, because that was where I hung out.
Yeah.
And that was on the very first professional boxing card that I ever had. So, I mean, you know, people fight out. People fight their way. That's why it's boxing. It gives them an opportunity to fight their way out of the position they're in life. So, you know, there you have it. Then, after you left there, did you continue to stay in boxing?
Yeah. I stayed in boxing with Oliver. Actually, I cut everything else back. You know, I had too many people. Actually, at one time, I can't remember all the names I had, actually, but one time in 97, I was managing 19 fighters.
Oh, wow.
You know, from Tyrone Taylor to I can't remember everybody. I had Kenny Bowman, and, you know. But then, you know, what happened when you get so many, you know, it's just like you can't watch everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got so many people who thieves of the night come in and want to steal your fighter. And when you, you know, when you're trying to do so much, and you know, and you do have to take care of what's paying your bills. And sometimes the people you're trying to help get started or get into, you know, you do neglect them more than what you should, I guess, because it's only one of me.
Instead of being a shepherd, you become a sheep herder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got tired of that. I was like, okay, everybody just go. And so, and that's really what made me, it's just the, and you know, and just like with the commissions and stuff, you know, it's, I mean, I have to say, to me, like you take them to the boxing with me back then, I look at what Donald Trump said today. You know, it's the system needs to be changed.
Right.
Because it's a bad system.
Right.
And you got some people make calls to the system of boxing that's never even boxed.
Right.
Oh, never yeah. even been in it. Don't right. even have a clue what they're talking about.
Right.
And they want to act like they're an expert at it, and they're not.
Right.
And, yeah, you got to follow that lead. And I just, like, I just got tired of all the garbage. When I, like, say, when I bought Rudy Bowe back, I bought him to Nashville. I got really bold because what he done, you know, brain damage and all that, you know. Listen, we went through all these tests, and we proved that the really bold said he was brain damaged was because of the situation. He got him less jail time for the incident with his wife.
Okay, so it was a legal strategy.
Yeah.
Okay.
His ex-manager at the time, Rock Newman, told him, said, "This is what we're going to do. We won't fight no more." We said, "Yeah, and you're done. You trying to stab your wife because your mind left you."
Okay.
He got less time in jail for that.
So Rock Newman told him to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we proved that in documents. And so we got licensed everywhere we wanted to fight except for Tennessee.
Okay.
And it was the most irritating thing when we come here and we've done everything they asked for, and still we end up in court trying to fight for a license to fight in Tennessee.
And it was, where did this incident take place at? I wasn't even here, was it? It was
we went to, it was in California.
Okay.
Reddit Boat.
Where did that incident?
Wife?
Yeah, where did
Oh, it was in Washington.
Okay.
It's in Washington. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was taken to North Carolina or something.
Okay.
And, you know, but anyway, she willing was going, and all of a sudden she just flipped the script on him and went inside, called the cops, said she was kidnapped. You know, so like Bo said, if I kidnapped her, why would I let her go into the restroom by herself?
Right, right.
If I kidnapped her.
Sure.
He said, she told me she had to pee. I pull over, go to McDonald's, get something to eat, and she goes in the restroom, calls the cops on him.
Okay.
Now, he said, if I kidnapped her, why not stop at McDonald's and let her run free to do whatever?
Right.
But anyway, they...
And he had the children in the car, too.
Had the kids, too.
Right.
So...
But that was whenever it all came out with his oldest son not being his.
Yes. So then what we've done... We come here, so I started to fight Tennessee because, you know, what happened was the commission just wasn't together. And so the commission, and my final incident was, they said, well, we don't trust you.
What?
We don't trust you because you allow homeless. You took homeless and fought underneath us. And that's when I made the remark in the courtroom. I said, I ain't the commission. Mm-hmm. You're the one who cleared them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the one who allowed them to get into the ring. So if they was homeless and no good and they wasn't this and that, you, the commission itself, should have found that out. So I got in a little spat with the commission.
So how can they make some kind of disparaging remark like that without any kind of documented proof?
They did, though. And so what happened is we never got licensed, and we got licensed everywhere but in Nashville.
Okay.
In Tennessee. And so we went to Oklahoma. I took him to Oklahoma. We had a fight in Oklahoma with...
When they say homeless, were they saying like that they were like living on the streets?
Yeah.
And coming in and fighting?
Under the bridge, under the bus station. And
okay.
I said, I don't know what you're talking about, which I don't. I owe my hand to God.
All of your fighters, were that I remember, were brought in from out of state. All of the opponents were brought in from out of state.
Yeah.
So, to my knowledge, I mean, you had guys like Billy Mitchum. And
I had Billy Mitchum, Bobby Mitchell. Uh-huh. I had Walter Johnson. And what happened, they had a stable of fighters.
Right.
And they'd bring that. No, actually, it was no different than what you do now with the Golden Gloves.
Right, right.
People take their stable of fighters and come here and fight, except it was pro.
Right.
Cause I had the same thing.
Yeah.
So I was never in charge with the, you know, only thing I looked at, when I matched fighters for my fighters, opponents, when I talked to them, they'd tell me who they have. The main thing I was always interested in was your record.
Uh-huh.
I always look to find out what's his record and what his knockout ratio is. Because
mm-hmm.
I got a fighter, if you're going to go against a fighter who has no punching power and has had 20 fights, and he's only knocked out one person.
Mm-hmm.
And if I got a fighter that got some good punching power and can move,
mm-hmm.
I'm not scared to fight that fighter.
Right.
Because he ain't got no knockout power, so okay, we can get hit. But you have to be careful, and that's how I always try to judge my fighters that way. When I look at the opponent, I say, okay, bring him on.
Gotcha.
And so when the fighters came in there and to go into commission and get cleared, I never even seen them. But when I went through this court thing with Rudy Bowe here, mm-hmm. I was just this master pimp. Mm-hmm. They just did everything like that,
They thought you were a mastermind behind the whole thing.
Yeah, okay. And I wasn't.
Right.
And, it's just like I say, when you took your loss to Tom Gavin,
mm-hmm.
did you think that's what I wanted? Because you was working with me.
Actually, I wasn't at that. I don't think I was at that time, but that fight got me to working with you.
Yeah, but what happened is, but I still wouldn't want it to happen because you did come to work with me.
That's
why I wanted to help you clean that record up.
Yeah, I wanted that.
And every time I see you, can you get that fight for me?
Yeah.
I closed his eye.
I busted his nose. I tore him all up. I couldn't figure out why in the world I'd lost that fight. I was like, what in the world?
You know what? And I didn't figure it out either. Because you won the fight. Because when I heard that decision, I go like, what? I mean, it was a good fight. I mean, you took him to school.
Ah, well, hey, you can't win them all. And so you decided. Well, let me ask you this, because Riddick Bowe had how many fights did he fight in his comeback with you?
Two.
Okay, and he won them both.
He won them both, but what happened with Bowe after we fought? We went to the reservation and. It was in California. I forgot the name of that. But we went there, and the little boy, I forgot who it was who he fought. The guy came to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the guy was a decent fighter, because I looked at his record, a decent fighter. But, he always ran out of gas, or even he got knocked out by anybody who could punch.
Uh-huh.
Well, Bo could punch, too. He can punch. But Bo still had weight on him. But Bo just wanted to stay active. So, We took Dan Goosen, the one who got the fight for us, and we fought on Goosen card. And so we took in this guy came to fight. When the guy came, I didn't even recognize the guy, because in the pictures I've seen the guy before, a little chubby, not fat, but a little me. But he came in and I looked at him, I said, what? This is a guy? But he was ripped, and he come, and to him, he was going to take his... He wanted to take his glory and beat Riddick Bowe.
Right.
And he trained for it. And, man, he got in that ring. He fought.
Mm-hmm.
He fought. We won a decision. But when we got in the car to go back, to go somewhere, we went to go somewhere, and Bo's up front, and I'm sitting in the back, me and my wife's in the back, and I noticed Bo's blood run out of Bo's ear.
Mm-hmm.
And it was running out of his ear. And so, anyway, I told Bo, and that's my last fight with Bo. I said, no, because when I seen that blood come out of his ear, no matter his eardrum, no matter what, they done a test on him.
He feared for his health.
They done a test on him. And he done all the tests, touching his nose, he done all this stuff with him. I took him to the doctor, and his wife, that's what she wanted to. We took him to the doctor, and they had all these MRIs and all done again, and all checked out. But what happened was his balance. When the doctor asked him to stoop down and walk backwards, a duck walk, asked him to do the duck walk,
mm-hmm.
he done a duck walk forward, fine. Then he said, do the duck walk backwards. And he couldn't do it.
Oh.
And I said, I'm done.
Right. Well, so do you think that I mean, obviously he's not, brain, well, I mean, do you think that he took too many punches in the ring?
Yeah, I just don't think he should box someone.
I think it kind of stemmed from the Galata wars.
Galata messed him up.
Yeah.
Yeah, Galata messed him up. Galata, he took so many hits in the head by Galata. Them two fights with Galata were not two fights he should have done.
Oh, they were absolute wars. And to be honest with you, if Galata hadn't got disqualified in both those fights, I don't know that he would have won. I mean, they were brutal back and forth wars. But not only that, remember the wars with Holyfield.
Yeah. I mean, Bo had wars. I mean, he had war fights. You know, he's one of the fighters that fought wars. And I think they caught up with him at the end.
Why do you think he would never really? Why did he dump that belt, the WBC belt, into the big trash can? Why wouldn't he fight Lennox Lewis? Was he fearful that you think that the whole Olympic Games thing was going to happen all over again when Lennox Lewis knocked him out?
Political. I think he done the belt because of Rock Newman. Okay. He loved Rock Newman, and he would do anything Rock Newman say do.
Okay.
And I think it was just a game that Rock Newman wanted to play because Bo was not scared to fight Lewis. He wanted to fight Lewis. He wanted to fight Lewis even when I started working with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he started calling him out. Okay. He wanted to fight him. I mean, he wanted to fight him in ways that now.
Okay.
And so, and Bo is not a coward.
So it wasn't Bo, it was Newman that was.
In my belief, my opinion.
That didn't want Lewis.
Yeah, because, what happened is you get. And it's boxing. You get these wars of these promoters. And I mean, prime example, Muhammad Ali law. The Muhammad Ali law was started by John McCain. And it was all based upon Carl King, Don King. Look what everybody else does.
Right.
They don't call out everybody else. It was just pointed at Don King.
Right, right.
And so, and that's what I'm saying. Once again, you got somebody putting the 2 cents in that don't even know the fight game. They don't know what they don't know what you can go through to get in a fight game.
Right, right.
And it gets that politics gets inside there. And like I say, the commission. I say when the commissions, Nashville had a good guy, mm-hmm. but you know what? He didn't have the budget to do the things. Like I say, they wouldn't do a AEs test.
Okay.
They didn't have the money.
Right.
So there's a lot of things that should have been done, even we had these fights here, that the commission was not allowed to have because they didn't have the budget to do it.
Okay.
So, I'm always for having an AIDS test.
Uh-huh.
You know, that blood.
Sure.
But, Tennessee, there for a while, they didn't. I don't know what they do now, but then for a while, you didn't have to have it.
I don't even know that was even thought of until Tommy Morrison.
Yeah.
Whenever he was scheduled to fight he had signed a contract to fight two guys and then Mike Tyson, and then on the very first guy he was supposed to fight, and this was with Don King, I believe.
Yeah.
And then the very first fight he went in to fight, he showed up positive, and when they brought my dad in, my dad thought he was like positive for like drugs, and he didn't know that it was HIV, which started a whole rampant thing about that. And I remember, golly, 97 also was another big year. That didn't happen in 97. That happened in 96.
96, yeah.
But in 97, do you also remember that was the year that that Tyson bit off
Holyfield's
ear? Yeah.
And also it was the year that Tupac got murdered.
Oh, was it that year?
Yeah, well, Tupac was at the fight.
Oh, I thought he was at the Frank Bruno fight. That was in 96, I think. And it was at the Frank Bruno fight whenever he got shot in Vegas.
Okay, and that's one because I was at that fight.
Okay,
when he got shot.
You so you were there?
DMGM and Tupac. I seen Tupac when he left in the car.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So you saw him the last time he was alive.
Yeah.
Oh wow, that is crazy.
Just 5 minutes down the road, and he was murdered.
The first time I met Mike Tyson was in 1984 at the National Golden Gloves.
Oh really?
And he was knocking everybody out. I saw him in '83. But didn't really meet him or anything. But in '84, he was there with Customata and he was knocking everybody out. And I went up, and that year I got all the winners to sign this program. And that year it was Virgil Hill, Vander Holyfield, Mike Tyson, because it was the 1984, right before the Olympics.
Yeah.
And, a lot of those guys went on to make the Olympic team. And I don't know if you remember, but Mike Tyson lost a very controversial decision to Tyrell Biggs.
Yeah.
It wasn't Tyrell Biggs. It was Henry Tillman. It was Henry Tillman. He lost a very controversial decision. Tyrell Biggs was a super heavyweight representative, and then Henry Tillman was the heavyweight representative, and he knocked him down like a couple of times in those amateur bouts, and they still gave the decision to Tyson in the Olympic trials. And then Tyson went on to become, what he did. It was so weird because I remember asking him for that autograph, and he was this beast of a man. He was like he was like 5'10", 5'11", 215 pounds, and he had on these black and white Rocky trunks this white tank top. He had on his boots. He had the tongue hanging out of them. and this headgear that looked like it was way too small for his head. And when I went up and asked him to sign it, I was shocked when he looked at me and goes, "Where would you like me to sign?" And I almost crapped on myself because I thought he was possessed by Michael Jackson or something. Yeah. It was like, what in the world? Because, you know, you had this bigger than life man knocking everybody out. And then he talks like this, and I was just, "Where would you like me to?" You know, I said, "Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. Sure." I was like, "Oh my gosh, holy cow." And then it wasn't, but about a year or two later, he was the heavyweight champion of the world. We're all playing his video game.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big deal.
Yeah, that's a deal. That's a story in itself.
Yeah, yeah. So did you ever work with Mike whenever?
Never worked with him. I mean, I've met him several times, but I've never worked with him, no.
Isn't it? It's kind of neat to watch how he's reinvented himself now. Reminds me a lot of George Foreman, the way he reinvented himself.
I'm really proud of him. Of what he's turned into now.
Right,
I mean, because, you know, well, to me, I compare him to like a Britney Spears. You know, Britney Spears, when she went through her moment, no, I'm proud of Britney Spears. I'm not a Britney Spears fan, but I'm proud of how she come back.
Sure.
The whole world went against her.
Everybody loves a comeback story.
Yeah, and she got a great comeback to doing what she's doing now, the album where it's at. And then Mike Tyson, same thing, with that downfall he took, and he took a downfall, but to come back. But I think what got Mike more than anything else, anything else when he lost his daughter. And I can only imagine a man losing a child. But I think when he lost his daughter, that really made him snap to do a, mm-hmm. to, hey, wait a minute. And I really think that played a big part. But like today, I mean, he helps people. I mean, he's a good dude. But I think one thing about Mike that people had a hard time deal with him today, he tells the truth. I mean, he don't candy coat nothing.
Sure.
And not even today.
No filter. Absolutely.
You got no filter.
Right.
And, you know, and see, I've learned that some things that a fighter sees from perspective, see, because I've been on both sides of the fence, a lot of it. And from a promoter to a manager, I mean, it's easy to get them jobs mixed up. It's easy to think, okay, well, my manager's not doing right, promoter's not doing right, and then make them not do right or whatever, you know. And I think sometimes in relationships and in sports, in the game of sport, it's just communication and taking that extra 5 minutes to talk and understand what each other's about. Because I don't mean it's wrong, and a lot of people question and say that I'm lying about it, but to me, I was a damn good manager because I cared about my fighters. And like I say, when I did the Mix Factory, I was involved with that. I was involved with Luck. I loved what we was doing together. Mm-hmm. But I seen the picture bigger than the Mix Factory. A lot of people got caught up in just the Mix Factory. And so when I walked away from it, a lot of hopes and dreams failed. And I didn't mean it for it to be like that, because where do you go now?
Sure, sure.
And when you take these other steps, you know, of course, they only set you up for real failure.
Right, right.
In front of the world. So when you fail down the Mix Factory, you fail down there. But still, it was giving you a legit records of winning. It was building you as a pro boxer.
Right.
It was building your identity of who you can be. But see, it's just like, say, when you step out there on stage, you got to be able to perform.
Right. So all of those guys that were associated with that, where are they now? Or what was their story? What ended up happening to them? The Jeff Hargis, the Jimmy Westmoreland, it was an Paul Eichel. Whatever happened to those guys? It's like you're the only one that's still around, that's still either in or around or still doing something, you know, productive. Or not necessarily productive, because I don't know what they're doing.
I think I've heard that Jim Westmoreland's back, but he's still in Virginia, and he sells insurance, is what I hear.
Okay.
Of course, you know, him and I don't talk anymore. We haven't talked because it's my fault, because he's selling insurance or whatever, because I didn't carry him with me. But I'm a firm believer, if I get in business with you, and I look at it, and I want you to look at it the same way.
Sure.
If I get in business with you, and we're going to run a lap of 500 laps of what we're running, and we run 499 laps and you quit, to me, you lost the race.
Right.
If I go on and make that 500 lap, I won.
Right.
So I'm not one of these that reach back and say, okay, I'm going to give you that lap. Because you know what? That lap cost me too damn much.
Right, right.
It was hard. It was easy for me. It's just as easy for me to quit as they did.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't.
Right.
Now, if I had to go with today, would I redo it all? Probably not.
Okay.
Because, you know, it was so much. And so, but then again, I'm very thankful. You know, I believe in my God so much. And so right now, I'm here today alive with all the health issues I've had because of my good Lord and because of my wife.
Right.
Because my wife has been like an angel to me, and she takes care of me. But I ain't done. I'm coming back from a sickness. I've been down for 9 months.
Mm-hmm. I want to go into great detail about what it is that you're doing today too. But I just want to kind of like cover some of this ground that we're still on here.
Okay.
Hargis. He's a doctor now, right? Or he's a like a somebody said he was not a doctor, a chiropractor or something.
I don't know. I'm gonna tell you, Hargis and I had. Hargis and I, we went separate ways, and we went against each other.
Okay. What do you mean against each other?
Well, we just didn't like each other.
Oh, okay.
You know, we just didn't like each other.
Okay.
But you know what? I have to thank Hargis because Jeff Hargis, because he took in, and he one who had, he had the mixed factor together.
Okay.
He's the one who induced me to it, you know, and so... And we, he's the one who helped me get started in the mixed factory.
Okay.
So, you know, I've seen Hargis.
So, in all truthfulness, then, there wouldn't be a honky-tonk hitman without Jimmy Adams, and there wouldn't be a Jimmy Adams without Jeff Hargis.
Right.
Okay. At least there wouldn't have been a mixed factory series.
Wouldn't have been a mixed factory series.
Right, right.
Jeff Hargis and Paul Eichel, of course, you know. And so, what happened was, but Jeff Hargis is the one who got the license.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've seen things one way, and Jeff seen things another way, and we just didn't agree.
Okay.
And then, you know, and maybe I was cockier than I should have been at times, and maybe he was too, but we just didn't agree. But I had a meeting first of the year. I had a meeting.
This year?
Yeah, I think it was first of the year. I had a meeting with a guy who came in from New York, and we went to the steakhouse downtown, and the waiter set me in a booth right beside Jeff Hargis. And we haven't seen him all this year.
Okay.
And I got up, and he got up, and I looked at him, and I said, hey, let's bury the hatchet. And I said, listen, I'm sorry, what have I done wrong? And he said, I'm sorry, what have I done wrong? And we hugged, shook hands, and hugged each other, and he gave me his card and said, hey, why don't you come see me? This is where I'm at now, over the Union Station.
So is he a chiropractor?
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't even ask what he was doing.
Okay.
He told me he's up on top of Union Station, and we hugged each other and said, hey, it's bygones are bygone. And that was really good for me. I mean, I was glad because, you know, during your life, but, you know, anytime you're going to succeed at something, it causes something, somebody's going to get hurt. Doesn't matter. Whatever you go after in your life, you know, somebody that's close to you ain't going to like what you do.
Sure.
It's going to hurt them. And it's sad. Because they expect you really to stop.
Right, right, right.
But then again, you realize you got to make a living. I got a dream I want to fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to understand, you know, people are going to get hurt. It's just like my hometown. I love my hometown. I miss my family back there. But, you know, and it's not their fault. It's my fault. I just don't feel like I fit no more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like I heard, really, my mama passed away. And I went back to my mama's funeral, of course. And through the grapevines, you don't know what's true or not, because what happened, people don't talk directly to you, that they talk around to you.
Okay.
And so I went back there, you know, and I've been blessed. So I went back there in my Mercedes, my H2 Hummer, because I took a crew with me, like here, and my Bentley. And so... got back and went through a hard time, and my mom was being buried and all. And I get back here to Tennessee, I get this call from a member of family and said, hey, you know, everybody out here thinks you just come to your mama's funeral just to show off with all your fancy cars. Well, you know what? It's all I had.
Mm-hmm.
Them cars I drive every day. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
If I go to a meeting, I mean, I might get in my Bentley. Now, you know, since then, I bought me a Ford truck and a Ford Mustang. But still...
trying to look like you're Nashvilleian,
Yeah, but still, you know, I drive Bentleys and Mercedes.
Right.
And I'm not bragging. I'm fortunate that I can do that, you know. I might not be able to do it next month, but I'm okay.
I see you in a big black Cadillac.
Oh, look, I want a Rolls. My next move was a Rolls. I mean, you know, and I don't want it for nobody, but, you know, first I got to get this new baby done, you know. But but I want to take it, and you know, but I hate that family feeling like I'm above... or whatever, and I'm not. You know, I worked hard. I worked hard.
You think there's some jealousy there?
Of course.
Yeah.
But anytime people get jealous of and it's not what I'm not jealous. Listen, I hope everybody in my family, no matter how what kin they are to me,
sure,
succeed and end up $1 billion.
But I don't even think it's just your family. I think that's everybody. I, for whatever reason, when people start to have success, you know how you know when you're being successful? Because you start to draw haters. And haters, success draws haters. That's just a fact.
And you know, Mike, I hear all this stuff about me. And I guess with age, because before I could tell you, I don't care. I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to don't like me, I don't care, because I ain't got to like you, you know. But, you know, since you go through, and you know, because you've been through it yourself, when you get sick and you come close to dying.
Yes.
And you started realizing what's really important to you. And it's not that Bentley sitting outside.
Right.
You know? And you said that, and it's not no material thing whatsoever you own. It's not that. But, you know, I thank God that I was able to be able to see the importance of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say, I truly miss my family, but I don't fit no more.